What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back to our episodes on interstate killers, I guess. This is part two of talking about the I-70 killer, but specifically focusing today on the I-65 killer and if he could be the same person. Okay. So if you missed our last episode, go back and listen to that first, because we covered the I-70 killer, who committed at least 5 murders in the Midwest in the 1990s in stores off of Interstate 70. And this man has never been identified. We talked all about it in the last episode, so go listen to that to catch up.
Yeah.
But there is some speculation that the recently identified I-65 killer could be the same man. So we're going to deep dive into the I-65 killer. I'm going to tell you all about his crimes and him. And then at the end, we'll talk about why people suspect that he could potentially be the I-70 killer.
I'm curious because I wonder, does he even look like the guy, the sketches?
You will see.
Okay.
On February 21st, 1987, 41-year-old Vicki Lucille Heath was working at the Super 8 Motel in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Vicki was born and raised in Hardinsburg, Kentucky, where she eventually met and married her husband. And the two raised their son and daughter there. But after the kids grew up and moved out, the couple ended up drifting apart and eventually got divorced.
No.
In early 1987, Vicki had a new fiance, and she actually agreed to move with him to Radcliffe, Kentucky. So this was kind of a part of Vicki getting a fresh start. And as a part of that, she also began working as a night auditor at the Super 8 Motel in the neighboring town, Elizabethtown.
Okay.
So as the night auditor, she basically got to monitor the hotel, work the desk overnight, which was usually a pretty quiet shift. So this allowed her to do her favorite hobby while she was working, reading romance novels. So she really liked the job because, you know, she got paid for it. It was usually pretty quiet and she got to read during it. Now, Elizabethtown is a small town. It's best known as being Abraham Lincoln's birthplace, but other than that, not much is going on in that town. And the Super 8 Motel was right next to a Days Inn motel. The two were separated by a large parking lot where truck drivers would, you know, park, get some sleep. So they were pretty close together.
And I assume they're in close proximity to the interstate.
Yes, Elizabethtown is, or the area that the hotels were in Elizabethtown is right off the I-65, so a lot of truckers would stop there. If you didn't know, the I-65 is a major truck route in the U.S. It's a north to south highway that runs through the Midwest, and it is a major trucking route that a lot of truck drivers take, and so these motels were, you know, right off the I-65, and oftentimes, like, truckers or other people who traveled for work would stop and stay there overnight.
Okay.
So the night of February 20th, 1987 was a normal, quiet night at the motel. The manager worked with Vicki until 11 p.m., recalling that nothing was out of the ordinary. And when he left for work for the night, Vicki was ready for a totally normal overnight shift. Unfortunately, though, that shift would be nothing near normal.
Mm-hmm.
At 6:38 a.m. the next morning, the Elizabethtown Police Department got a call from a motel guest reporting that the lobby was, quote, in a complete mess, in total disarray. So furniture in the lobby had been overturned, there were items scattered all around, and the payphone had even been ripped from the wall. So it was just a mess. It clearly looked like there had been a fight, a struggle, something that had gone on here.
Right.
And even more odd than that was that no hotel staff were to be seen. There was no hotel employees anywhere in the lobby. When the first police officer arrived at the scene, he initially theorized that there had been a violent brawl between several people the night before. So he began searching the motel while he waited for backup. During his search, he discovered Vicki Heath. Vicky's body was laying in the mud behind the motel's dumpster.
Oh my God.
She was covered in blood. She was wearing the clothes she had on the night before, but her clothes were all tangled and ripped up, indicating that there had been a struggle. She had been sexually assaulted and then shot twice in the back of the head with a 38 caliber handgun.
Okay, so 38 as opposed to a 22.
Yes.
Okay.
But still a handgun.
Right. And two times.
Mm-hmm. It was clear that a violent attack on Vicky had taken place, but what was not known to police was who did it or why they did it. They were like, what just happened here?
Yeah.
They were able to get DNA both from the assault and from Vicky's clothing. But remember, this is 1987, so at the time, the DNA led nowhere.
Yeah.
The investigation began quickly, and officers began searching the crime scene pretty diligently, and they actually found a set of muddy footprints leading away from the body to the parking lot, where they theorized that the killer got into a car and drove away. But it had snowed that night, and the snow was already starting to melt, so they basically weren't able to get anything from the footprints or from the tire tracks from the car.
Right.
So their initial thought was that Vicky was targeted. So they started looking into her background and they found nothing. There was no indication that she was being targeted at all. So they realized this was a random attack and they had pretty much nothing to go on.
Dang.
Vicky's murder was absolutely horrifying. And for years, investigators assumed it was a one-off case that would likely never be solved. As DNA technology progressed, though, they ended up submitting the DNA evidence from Vicky's murder to CODIS, and they got a match. In 2010, the Kentucky State Police announced that DNA had linked Vicky's murder to two other murders that happened in Indiana in March 1989. So that's when they realized they had a serial killer on their hands, but they had no clue who he was.
I can't imagine that feeling of finding out, oh my God, there is a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking so it's just many a one-off. Later, yeah, that's insane. Literally
23 years after the murder, they're like, wait a minute.
These are connected.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So let's talk about the other two murders linked to this killer. Mary Margaret, or Peggy Gill, was 24 years old in March 1989. She was the youngest of four, and she lived with her parents, Anna and Terry, in Merrillville, Indiana. Peggy was extremely creative. She loved to bake and make art during her time at Merrillville High School. After high school, Peggy began attending a business college, and to help pay her way through, she began working at the Days Inn Hotel in Merrillville as a maid. She was a hard worker, and she was quickly promoted to night auditor, where she would man the front desk overnight. Peggy was known as being a bit shy, so she preferred those overnight shifts because it was a lot quieter. She could draw, paint, and cross-stitch during her shift, and it was just pretty calm. Merrillville is an hour southeast of Chicago, and the Days Inn was right off of the I-65, making it a perfect location for truckers to stop for the night. On the afternoon of May 2nd, 1989, Peggy was planning her father's birthday party for the next day. So she was decorating his cake and spending time with him before she had to go to work.
No.
And before she left for work, she gave him a hug and said, quote, early happy birthday, old man.
No, that's sweet.
Peggy got to work at 11 p.m. where she met up with the clerk working the previous shift. And not long after the start of her shift, Peggy spoke on the phone with the hotel's manager, Betty Pierce. She described a slow, boring night, and everything seemed normal. Between 1:30 and 1:40 a.m., a new guest checked into the hotel, again reporting nothing unusual. But by 2 a.m., when the next guests arrived to check in, that would change. The 18-year-old college student entered the hotel, but found no employees in sight. He waited for over 5 minutes, but nobody came out to the front desk, so he decided to just go to a neighboring hotel. There was no other reported activity for the next 3 hours, but at 5 a.m., the manager, Betty Pierce, did not receive the regular phone call from Peggy that she always received. Mm-hmm. So it had become a routine for the night auditor to call Betty at home at 5 a.m. to just confirm nothing had happened overnight. And this became a thing after several of the hotels in the area had been robbed recently. So they kind of just did it for like safety, peace of mind,
right,
just to make sure everything was okay. So when Betty received no phone call, she was immediately worried. She began calling the hotel, but no one answered. And so she knew pretty quickly that something was wrong.
Yeah.
She called 911, and by 6 a.m., the Merrillville Police Department arrived at the Days Inn. The first officer on the scene found no employees in the lobby, despite several customers, you know, standing there waiting to check out. Peggy's car was still in the hotel parking lot, and her keys and wallet had been left on the front desk.
Mm.
They called Peggy's home to see if maybe she had, like, gotten another ride home or for, you know, some reason had gone home, but she was not there. In contrast to the Super 8 motel murder, though, there weren't really any signs of a struggle, so they didn't immediately think that something bad had happened. They assumed maybe Peggy had left for some reason, maybe she wasn't feeling well. Like, they really didn't think that anything major happened, and they assumed that she would be found alive and well.
Yeah.
But this actually changed when the manager, Betty, arrived at the scene. So she discovered that the cash drawer had been, quote, opened with significant force. There was about $179 missing, so not a ton, but, you know, something missing.
Was that all the money that was in there, or did it specify?
I believe so.
Okay.
It didn't specify, but they made it sound like it was all the money that was taken.
Okay.
There just wasn't a lot in the cash register at the time. So with this discovery, officers shifted their thinking to this being an armed robbery. That's when Betty informed officers that there was actually a vacant wing of the hotel that was closed off in the winter months. So they began searching that wing, and that's when they found a horrific scene. At the end of a hallway, which was basically the furthest point in the hotel from the lobby, Peggy's body was discovered. She had been sexually assaulted and shot in the head twice with a .22 caliber gun.
Oh.
Next to her body, her clothes were laid neatly folded up, which was very odd.
That is weird.
And there were no other obvious signs of a struggle. So the investigation into Peggy's murder quickly evolved from an attack that happened in the lobby to a different story. So investigators believed that the attacker had entered the lobby, robbed Peggy at gunpoint, and then led her to the vacant wing and down the hallway.
Right.
She was likely then forced to remove her clothing, and she instinctively folded it up and laid it on the ground, which would explain why it was folded.
Yeah.
The attacker then assaulted and murdered her. It is believed that Peggy, who was naturally quiet and cooperative, likely gave in to the attacker's initial demands in the hopes that he wouldn't harm her. There was DNA taken from the scene, but again, it's the 80s. Nothing at the time could be done. Police were not super sure of the motive. They basically believed it was robbery and assault that escalated. And like with Vicky's murder, it did not seem like it was targeted, but it was random.
Right.
That is, until they realized that another Days Inn, just an hour away, an identical crime took place that same night.
The same night?
Mm-hmm.
Dang, that's bold.
Yeah. Jeanne Marie Gilbert grew up in Jasper County, Indiana, with her parents Andrew and Patricia. When she was young, Jeanne married her husband and had two kids, a boy and a girl. The couple ended up divorcing when the kids were teenagers, and Jeanne and the kids moved in with her parents. So that's where they were living in May 1989. Jeanne worked as a bookkeeper for Carter Oil Supply, but she had actually recently begun working at the Days Inn as a second job to supplement her income. This Days Inn was located in Remington, Indiana, just 50 miles away from the Merrillville Days Inn. Similarly, it was just off the I-65, but this one was actually quieter because it was a smaller town in a more remote area. So Remington's population is around just 1,000 people, and most of the surrounding area is rural farmland and some homes, so it's a pretty desolate town.
Okay.
So the Days Inn was usually pretty quiet, especially at night. Jeanne began working as a night auditor at this Days Inn, spending her evenings manning the front desk of the usually quiet, relatively empty hotel. On Thursday, May 2nd, 1989, Jeanne actually switched shifts with another coworker because she wanted to be able to attend her daughter's cheerleading event the next day. So that evening, she went into work at 11 p.m. When the second front desk clerk left their shift at around midnight, everything seemed normal. Jeanne spent the next several hours working on homework for the college classes she was taking and monitoring the front desk. At around 4:30 a.m., and this Days Inn was in Central Time, so it's an hour earlier than Eastern Time where the other one took place.
Okay.
So this is technically 5:30 a.m. in Merrillville. So at this time, Jeanne made a wake-up call to a guest. Completely normal. But an hour and a half later, the Jasper County Sheriff's Office began receiving phone calls from hotel guests saying that there were no employees there to check out. So police arrived at the scene. They found that an employee that had been the morning shift employee was waiting to be let in because she didn't have her own key, and the registration office door was locked.
Okay.
So with that, police couldn't get in either, and they called the hotel's manager, Sharon Krug. When Sharon arrived at the scene and let the officers in, they found that Jeanne wasn't there, and the cash drawer had been pried open with $247 missing. And still at the hotel was Jeanne's purse, keys, and school books.
Wow, that's, like you said, identical almost to the other crime.
Yeah. At almost exactly the same time, the Indiana State Police received a phone call from a bus driver in White County, which was the neighboring county to Jasper, so not far. The caller reported seeing a nude female body lying on Country Road 150 West.
No.
When the ISP and White County police arrived at the scene, they found what the caller reported. The woman was nude and appeared to have been sexually assaulted, murdered, and dumped on that road. She was wearing only her socks and shoes and had some jewelry on, but her clothes were nowhere to be found. It did not take long for that body to be identified as 34-year-old Jeanne Gilbert. So she had several scrapes on her body, indicating that she had either been dragged, like dragged out of a vehicle, or fought back, or both. She had been shot three times, once in the head, once in the shoulder, and once in the torso. And the shot to her torso is actually what ended up killing her, and she died from, like, internal bleeding.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So that's different.
Mm-hmm. She was shot with a .22 caliber gun. And just like the other two murders, there was DNA left behind, but nothing could be done at the time.
Right.
So these crimes were connected relatively quickly, but the initial investigation was clouded by confusion on the timeline because the two counties were in different time zones. So it was confusing. They were trying to figure out the timeline. But eventually, when the Indiana State Police took over the investigation, things were ironed out and they were able to put together what they believed happened. So it is believed that the killer entered the hotel between 4:30 and 5 a.m. after Jeanne had made that wake-up call. He then robbed her at gunpoint and forced her out of the hotel using her keys to lock the registration office door. It is believed that the killer then began driving Jeanne down the I-65, taking exit 188, which is the first exit between the Days Inn and where she was found that didn't have any, you know, signs for a hotel or gas or food.
Okay.
So if you've ever driven on interstates in the U.S., oftentimes exits will have signs that say, stop here for a hotel or gas or food, and it kind of like indicates what's there. This was the first exit that didn't have one of those signs, meaning it was likely a less populated area.
Right. A good place to dispose of a body.
Mm-hmm. So it is believed that he ended up reaching an empty clearing on Country Road 150 West and there he assaulted, killed, and dumped Jan's body. A witness from a farm that was not far from where Jan's body was found actually came forward saying that he heard gunshots around 5:30 that morning. So that lined up with the timeline. And they actually did get a description of a vehicle in the area from another witness, but it's never been reported if that was followed up on. So it's unclear if the police didn't think that that was the vehicle or if they did follow up on it and it led nowhere. Like, there's just no reporting on what happened with the vehicle.
Okay.
So despite these witness accounts, Jan's case quickly went cold. And all three of these murders remained cold for the next 30 years. And they weren't all connected until much later.
It's wild.
So the two murders in Indiana, as I said, were connected pretty early on. And at first, investigators didn't think that one man could commit both of these murders in one night. Yeah. But they looked at the timeline and, you know, the distance between the hotels and just the similarity between the two cases. Like you said, they were like identical.
Yeah.
So they were able to conclude pretty early on that these were connected. And the killer was then dubbed the Days Inn Murderer.
Okay.
But who this man was remained unknown. In 1989, the Indiana State Police assembled a task force to work on Peggy and Jan's cases. And they were able to further link the two murders because fragments from the bullets in both cases were shown to be from the same weapon.
Right.
There was one initial suspect who was the 18-year-old college student who went into the Merrillville Days Inn at 2 a.m. and reported not finding an employee there.
Right.
And that was Peggy's hotel. So this man reportedly returned to the Days Inn the next day and began talking to the police on his own accord, which kind of confused investigators. Like, why would he do that?
Yeah.
But also, I feel like, you know, he was like an 18-year-old curious kid. In my eyes, he was probably just trying to, like, find out what happened.
Yeah, trying to get in on it.
Mm-hmm. No other hotels in the area reported renting him a room that night, which investigators found weird. But
yeah,
they found that there was no evidence to connect him to the crimes at all. So okay. He was cleared. An initial profile of the killer was created by police. They described him as a white male in his 20s or 30s, and they said he likely had some kind of prior criminal history. But when the FBI got involved, they disagreed, saying it was unlikely he had any criminal history. And we'll find out later, the FBI was actually wrong there.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So local police was on it, and the FBI was like, meh.
Yeah. So police believe that the killer likely traveled a lot, possibly being a trucker, a delivery driver, or a traveling salesman. The task force determined that the killer's initial motive was likely robbery, and then he impulsively made the decision to assault and kill the victims. But other than that, they had almost nothing to go off of, and no suspects were identified. So these cases went cold for the next year until the attackers struck again. About 140 miles south of Remington, Indiana, at a Days Inn in Columbus, Indiana, another attack happened. A 21-year-old woman who has never been named was working as the night auditor at that hotel. So it was a normal night until around 5 a.m. on January 2nd, 1990. A man walked into the hotel, started talking with the 21-year-old front desk clerk, and he asked for change for a cigarette machine, and then he was asking if there were any good restaurants nearby. So she named a few places that were open, and he left.
Okay.
About 15 or 20 minutes later, he returned with a cup of hot coffee, which he then proceeded to throw into the girl's face.
What?
He then jumped over the front desk and robbed the cash register and the woman's purse.
So fucked up.
So he forced her to give him the money in her purse and the rings that she was wearing. And he threatened her with a knife and forced her to the back of the hotel near a stairwell. So there he sexually assaulted her, then forced her outside through a side door. And the man told her, quote, "Don't turn around and keep walking." And she did as she was told. She kept walking and she walked for quite a while. She ended up walking through a shallow, frozen stream, up a small hill, and toward a residential area. And she believed the man was behind her this whole time.
Yeah, I would have kept walking too. I don't blame her for that. I mean...
Yeah. And by 5:55 a.m., she got to a point where she realized that the man was not behind her anymore. So she was able to be led into a trailer home by the resident that lived there, and she allowed the girl to call 911. And this woman did survive and was able to describe the attacker.
Awesome. I mean, not awesome that she went through it, but that she was able to describe him.
Describe him, yeah. And at first I was like, why the hell did he not kill her after all that he did? But I believe, and this is just my thought on it, that he didn't have a gun for whatever reason.
Oh.
Because, you know, he got the hot coffee and threw it in her face. He didn't have a gun to threaten her with. If he only had a knife, he might have thought that maybe she wouldn't listen if she wasn't incapacitated.
Right.
Like, you know, so I just don't think he had a gun, and that was the only way he wanted to kill someone.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Maybe it misfired, or maybe, like, it kept misfiring, so he was just like, nah. Not going to use this.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the victim recalled that the man was wearing blue jeans and a plaid shirt, a, quote, stereotypical looking blue collar trucker.
Right.
He was wearing a dark hat that almost fully covered his medium length brown gray hair, but the hair that she could see was greasy and matted. He had a long, full brown and gray beard with long whiskers. He was about 6 feet tall and appeared to be in his late 30s or early 40s.
Okay.
And the biggest thing that she remembered was that his eyes were bright green, almost yellow looking. Okay. She remembered that his right eye seemed to be lazy and he did not focus straight ahead.
Okay, so that's similar to I-70 mm-hmm. boy.
Yep. So a composite sketch of her description was created and was released the next day. But despite having this description and sketch, the suspect wasn't identified by anybody. This assault wasn't linked to the murders of Peggy and Jeanne until the next year, but eventually it was, and this was later confirmed to be connected through DNA.
Okay.
But again, this case went cold, and despite being connected in 1991... and the task force finally having a sketch of the suspect, they had no real leads.
Right.
In 1992, a man named Joseph Franco was arrested for abducting, assaulting, and mutilating a female victim. The mutilation that he did was carving I-65 into her chest.
What?
So this victim was let go and did survive. Oh my God. And Joseph Franco was found and charged with the crime. And because of the disturbing nature of what he did, the I-65 task force began looking into him as a potential suspect. However, they were able to clear him because his DNA did not match.
So maybe he was trying to do like some kind of copycat bullshit mm-hmm. or something. And
yeah.
Sick.
There were other suspects over the years, but they were each cleared by DNA. And the case into these murders went cold until 2010, when the Indiana State Police announced that they had officially connected Vicky Heath's murder to the murders of Peggy and Jeanne through DNA. And then in 2013, another match from CODIS came through. So this same perpetrator had assaulted a woman in Rochester, Minnesota in 1991. So this victim was sexually assaulted and stabbed, but had survived. And she described her attacker almost exactly as the 21-year-old assault victim had, including the bright green eyes and the lazy right eye. So they knew this was the same guy, and they believed that there may have been more victims, maybe victims that never reported their assaults or that just hadn't yet been linked. But with DNA technology continuing to advance, the victim's family and the task force were hopeful that one day the perpetrator would be identified. And that day would eventually come. On April 5th, 2022, police announced that they had identified the I-65 killer, also known as the Days Inn killer, who killed Vicky Heath, Peggy Gill, and Jeanne Gilbert, and had assaulted at least two other victims. This man was identified through genetic genealogy, and the ISP testing lab matched DNA from the crime scenes to a close family member, matching to this man with a 99.999% probability.
Dang.
This man was Harry Edward Greenwell. So let's talk about this monster of a human.
Okay.
Harry Edward Greenwell was born on December 9th, 1944, to Paul and Dorothy Greenwell. He grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, where he ended up getting into trouble starting in his late teens, early 20s. On January 17th, 1963, Greenwell was arrested for armed robbery, and he was sentenced to 2 years in a reformatory and 5 years on probation. 2 years later, on February 23rd, 1965, he was arrested again on a sodomy charge. But by 1969, he was paroled by the Kentucky State Penitentiary.
Wow.
He did get married, but in 1978, his wife tragically passed away in a house fire.
That's so sad.
I know. After her death, he started dating a single mother who had previously been in an abusive relationship. And they also ended up getting married, and Greenwell adopted her daughter. They had a son together, and Greenwell seemed to not get into too much trouble during this time. But in 1982, it happened again. He went to prison for burglary in Iowa. He actually escaped twice during his arrest, but was captured both times. But he only served a year in prison.
Oh, okay.
After his release, he began working as a railroad worker on tracks across the Midwest. For reference, the I-65 murders and attacks took place in 1987, 1989, 1990, and 1991. In the middle of all of this, he was actually arrested in Wisconsin for a traffic violation and domestic incident.
Jeez.
He was rearrested a month later for violating a restraining order, but he was only sentenced to 15 months probation. And this probation sentencing happened on April 18th, 1989, just 2 weeks before he killed Peggy and Jeanne.
Damn. So if he would have actually been sent to jail, that wouldn't have happened.
Yep.
Damn.
And he was never caught or suspected of these murders, but he had several other arrests throughout the years, always being sentenced to just short sentences or probation. He continued working as a railroad worker, and he was living in a small town where neighbors reported him as a kind, charismatic, generous man. His hobbies reportedly included gardening, going to farmers markets, reading, watching college sports and racing, and traveling.
Interesting. Doesn't sound like your run-of-the-mill serial killer.
No, and he was never suspected of the murders. In 2013... 68-year-old Harry Edward Greenwell died of lung cancer 9 years before he could be caught for the horrific crimes he committed.
Damn.
And unfortunately, because he died before he was caught, he never had to pay for anything that he did.
Yep. Well, he did die of lung cancer, and I heard that's pretty horrifying, so.
Yeah, so we can only hope his death was awful.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, according to his third wife, when Greenwell was dying of cancer, he asked to speak to a priest. And usually when somebody is dying and asks to speak to a priest, it's because they want to confess something.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, quote, I presumed it was for confession, but I doubt he confessed this. And then she also said, I just assumed that the priest would be obligated to tell somebody he did this if he did do this.
No.
But if you didn't know, Catholic priests are forbidden from sharing anything told to them during confession.
Yep.
So she was kind of like, if he confessed to other stuff but not this, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way to know what he confessed to, and the priest doesn't have to do anything.
He probably did confess to that because he knew that he wanted to be absolved of his... you know, transgressions, and mm-hmm. he knew that the Catholic priests couldn't say anything. They mm-hmm. they go under an oath. They can't.
Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely think he may have. So it is believed that Greenwell is linked to other crimes, including other assaults, robberies, and murders. And some believe he could be the still unidentified I-70 serial killer. So let's talk about why.
Okay.
So after Greenwell was identified as the I-65 killer, the task force working on the I-70 murders noticed that one physical trait of Greenwell closely matched the I-70 composite sketches, the lazy, droopy eye.
Mm-hmm.
So the composite of Greenwell that was made before he was identified and the composite of the I-70 killer do look eerily similar.
Yeah.
And I'll post the comparison on Instagram for you to see, but they definitely look similar.
They have very, like, narrow features, like long face, mm-hmm. narrow nose, kind of close together eyes.
Yeah.
Very similar.
They
do.
They definitely look similar. The task force also noted how similar the time frame of the murders are, because they would have worked out all of the identified murders and attacks that Greenwell committed were before the murders the I-70 killer committed, so the time frame would have worked out.
Right.
Captain Raymond Floyd of the St. Charles Police Department, who's heading up the task force, said, quote, "The time frame involved is just hard to ignore."
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, victims in both cases were shot in the head, and two of the I-65 victims were shot with a .22 caliber, as were all of the I-70 victims. We also know now that Greenwell traveled through the Midwest while working on railroad tracks, so it is definitely plausible that he traveled along the I-70. Now, of course, there are differences. Greenwell was taller than the height described of the I-70 suspect. Additionally, the I-65 victims were all sexually assaulted, while the I-70 victims were not. The biggest issue for me personally is Greenwell's green eyes. So both victims that described him before he was identified noted how bright his eyes were, saying they almost looked yellow. The I-70 suspect is described as having light eyes, but the two main eyewitnesses, who, if you recall from the last episode, were the customer from the bridal shop murder that got away,
mm-hmm.
and then the one victim in Texas who survived, they never noted the bright green eyes.
Right.
So it's possible that they didn't notice, but they both had conversations with the killer, and that's just, I feel like that's such a striking feature that you would notice that.
Right.
The other thing for me is the I-65 killings, while all similar, were all kind of different. The first one, everything was, you know, there was clearly a struggle in the lobby, things were a mess. The second one, there was no sign of a struggle, and she was killed in the hotel. And the third one, she was taken from the hotel and killed elsewhere and dumped. So there were kind of some differences and not a super consistent, like, yes, it's a consistent MO, but not the exact same.
Right.
Whereas the I-70 was pretty much exactly consistent.
Yeah.
So investigators have not ruled Greenwell out as an I-70 suspect. And they are continuing to work with authorities working on the cases of the murders he committed to try to find any connection. The I-70 task force led by Captain Floyd is determined to find the I-70 killer. And they are actually hopeful that advancements in DNA will allow testing on some of the small samples that they have from the different crime scenes. So it's been reported that these samples are currently being tested in various labs, both against just any suspect and against Greenwell, to see if they can be connected by DNA.
Okay.
One piece of evidence from an I-70 crime scene is reportedly in a DNA lab in Florida. And this piece of evidence is believed to have been touched or handled by the suspect. So it's not quite the same extent of DNA that they had in the I-65.
Right.
But they're hoping that touch DNA will be picked up and linked to someone. And they are hopeful this will happen. The I-65 killer was identified after over 30 years, and the same is very possible for the I-70 killer. Patricia Madgers, one of the I-70 victims' husband, Mark, is still hopeful. He recently said, quote, "So far I've been able to live life. It hasn't been easy, waking up every morning and rolling over and not having the person that you loved more than anybody on the face of the earth. But she's not there every morning."
So sad.
I know. But he says that he tries to focus on good memories he has of her, and he remains hopeful that one day the person who killed her will be caught. So I don't really know how I feel about these two killers being the same man. I'd love to think that he's been caught, but I just don't think the differences, and I don't think the differences between the two are enough to rule Greenwell out, but I don't think he should be fully ruled out until DNA can prove he was not involved.
Yeah, that's my thought too, because my gut is telling me that they're not the same just because of the description, like the, you know, very noticeable eye green color.
Yeah.
The height difference, I mean, that, you know, people can forget or, you know, remember something.
And the age difference.
Yeah.
Again, like, not as telling.
But also, like, the, obviously, and, you know, my experience, I guess you could say, I don't really have any experience, but, you know, usually these criminals, like, escalate, and to me, he was, like, starting out sexually assaulting the women, and then he stopped, so that doesn't really translate well for me, that part of it, either, so my gut's telling me that it's not, but
I just feel like possible. Even though they're somewhat similar, they're just different enough that it's not like, yes, for sure, he's the guy.
And it could be a copycat killer. I mean, that happens. Yeah. They get obsessed with these killings and then they do the exact same,
the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think he should be fully ruled out until they can say DNA from the I-70 cases do not match him.
Right.
But I just don't, I don't think that he's the guy, and I am very, very hopeful that 2023 will be the year that the I-70 victims, Robin, Patricia, Nancy, Sarah, Michael, and Patricia will get justice.
Me too.
So, I would love to know what you guys think about the two cases potentially being connected. I'm very curious. Maybe somebody has a perspective that we're not thinking of. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts.
Yeah.
So please, please, please let us know on Instagram and or Facebook. But that's all I have for you guys today. So until next week, keep it human.
Bye, guys.